Okay, so we're talking about what's commonly called electrophilic addition to alkenes. So the HOMO of the alkene is being attacked by some vacant orbital, some LUMO. But we're going to emphasize today that that's not all that's going on, that in most reagents there's also a nucleophile that participates at the same time. So last time we looked at acid-catalyzed hydration, and there the proton has no HOMO, it's just H+, so it can't have a HOMO that's attacking the alkene at the same time that the LUMO, the H+, is. Okay. The same is more or less true of oxymercuration reduction, and I want to talk about that. Here's a picture from the book that shows it. So it's a two-step reaction. The first involves mercury as its acetate salt, and then there's a second stage in which BH4- brings in the hydrogen. So we'll see how that happens here on the next slide. So here at the top we have an alkene, and the mercury cation comes up. It loses an acetate, so you have HgOAC+. That attacks the HOMO of the alkene. But mercury is much bigger than a proton. That means it's possible for it to overlap both of the carbons at the same time, where the hydrogen has a tough time doing that. So you remember in hydrogen, there was a bridge structure, but you could also have the hydrogen just attached to one carbon or just attached to the other. And we looked at it, it was a double minimum, that the hydrogen in the middle was on a transition state that connected going from one end to going to the other, right? So that was a rearrangement that could take place. But with mercury being bigger, it can overlap both at the same time, so it's now a single minimum. Now, so here's the mercury bound to both the carbons at the same time, the single minimum. But notice that it's not drawn symmetrically. It's drawn with a shorter bond on this side than on this side. Okay? And that's not surprising, because if we looked at the double minimum case, the double minimum, the minimum on one side, where it's in this case a secondary cation, would be lower than the minimum on the other side, where it's a primary cation. So the thing looks like this, right? And the lowest energy geometry has more of it being like a secondary than like a primary cation. And you can see that here drawn as resonance structures, that it's more like this than it is like this. So the mercury is closer to the carbon on the right than to the carbon on the left, and it's drawn here somewhat unsymmetrically. Now, what's the implication of that? The implication is that when an external nucleophile, the solvent water, attacks, it attacks the carbon that you might have thought would be less easy to attack because it's more hindered, right? But it's also has more cation there because of the importance of this resonance structure, okay? So that the water attacks at this position, not this position, and gives this isolable product with mercury attached to the one carbon and OH attached to the other, right? So being larger than H, mercury bridges near the middle, and that will prevent cation rearrangement. If you had used a proton in the first step and gotten a cation, it would be possible to have a rearrangement take place, right? But the mercury holds both carbons and prevents rearrangement. There is no carbon cation. Okay, so then in the second step, nobody wants the mercury compound. The reason this would be done is to add water, right? Now, and in this particular case, the book shows that you could use borodeuteride as the source of the hydrogen that replaces mercury, and then you could get a deuterium in that place. But what we're emphasizing is that the regiochemistry is that the OH goes to the more substituted carbon. Now, what would you have gotten had you used a proton at first? Which would you have gotten, the OH going to the more substituted or the less substituted carbon? Christine, you got an idea? they're two different structures, and if you added one, you'd get one, and you added the other, you'd get the other. But are they of equal energy, the two that you'd get when you added the proton? If you added the proton at this end, you'd get a secondary cation. If you added the proton at this end, you'd get a primary cation. So you'd get a secondary. So you get the secondary cation, the OH, the water, in the case where H, it just H plus it added, the OH would go in the same place. So you get the same product. It's the Markovnikov product. But the nice thing is that if you do it this way in two steps, there is no rearrangement. There would be a rearrangement if you'd used the proton. You get the same product. But it would have if it doesn't rearrange, you get the same product, but there's the risk of rearrangement if you use H plus first. So these are both a case where a simple nucleophile adds, or pardon me, a simple electrophile adds H plus or HG plus, and it can add to either one carbon or bridging between both carbons. But a more interesting case is the one that Professor Siegel previewed for us in here, where you add chlorine or bromine, or a chlorine atom that is two chlorines, two bromines, or a chlorine with OH, and we'll see how that happens. So here's ethylene, right? And it's reactive because of its HOMO, its pi. Okay, so now we want alumo to interact with that, an electrophile. So here's chlorine coming in, an electrophile. So what's its LUMO? What LUMO are we going to have in Cl2? Sunwa? What's the LUMO of Cl2? Right, sigma star. So the LUMO is sigma star, and it'll look like that. How does this look for a reaction? Pretty good? Not so good. Mac, what do you say? It's good overlap? No, it's crummy overlap, right? Both red and blue are overlapping. Can you do anything about that? Yeah. Rotate it. Right? Now we can get bonding. So the Cl2 should approach end on, not side on, to make the new bond. So there we have the LUMO of the electrophile, stabilizing the electrons in the HOMO. And we have antibonding there, so that indeed we'll have this take place, which looks very much like an SN2 reaction. Right? The nucleophile would be the pi electrons here, and the atom being attacked is a chlorine, and chlorine is a leaving group. Okay? So we would get the chloride anion and a chlorine, perhaps like mercury, bridging between both carbons, and you'll see that indeed it's bridging shortly. But chlorine in this case, as Professor Siegel referred to, is called an oxidizing agent because, from a formal purposes at least, it removes an electron from the alkene. Right? The alkene used these electrons to share here. This one took electrons away, so you got O minus, and now you've got plus with the carbons. And we'll talk a little bit more about oxidation and reduction, but you can see why it would be called an oxidizing agent, because it's taking electrons away. Okay, so that's the reaction. Now, here we have a HOMO on the P orbital there. And here's the HOMO of the product, the chlorine bridging between two carbons. And actually, it's not the HOMO, it's the HOMO minus 2. It's where the pi electrons went. The electrons that were in here now are in this region holding these things together. Okay? And it's much more stable because of the chlorine came in. So that's why it's not the HOMO anymore, it's the HOMO minus 2. But now, notice that this is drawn with two chlorine-carbon bonds. Can there be a second bond? We've talked about just one pair, the HOMO from ethylene mixing with that chlorine. Okay? But it's drawn with two bonds. Okay? You can also have the LUMO of the ethylene, which is unusually low because of the poor overlap with the HOMO of chlorine. Now, what are you going to have for a HOMO on chlorine? Derek? Lone pairs. In fact, what we see, and that makes chlorine a nucleophile as well as the sigma star making an electrophile. So you have the lone pair. In fact, the HOMO, the pi star of chlorine, is this. It's a p orbital here, but also a p orbital here. So a lone pair here, orbital, a lone pair orbital here, but they overlap with one another to give a favorable and an unfavorable orbital. And this is the unfavorable one. They're both occupied, so this one is the HOMO. Okay, but notice it's just right set up to overlap and share its electrons with a LUMO of ethylene. So we have a second pair of electrons being stabilized. And this is, remember, the previous one was the HOMO minus 2. This is the HOMO minus 1, right? So it's bonding between those two. So that's why we can draw two bonds from chlorine to carbon, and why it bridges even more strongly than the mercury would do, because there are two bonds being formed. Okay, so that we could draw this way. Okay, the HOMO of the chlorine mixing with the LUMO of ethylene. And now, what would the HOMO be? We saw the HOMO minus 2, the HOMO minus 1. What do you think the HOMO is of this compound, just for reference? Right, it's an unshared pair on the chlorine, mostly. Right, that's what's actually calculated, but it's an unshared pair on the chlorine. Okay, and this is the LUMO. Now, notice we have this LUMO. Well, would you expect that thing to be reactive? Chlorine in a three-membered ring with two carbons? What makes it reactive? There'll be strain involved, right? So it'll be like these three-membered rings we've seen being opened. And that, so a nucleophile could open by mixing with this LUMO, which is, notice, anti-bonding between carbon and chlorine. So if we put an electron there, it'll break that ring. Where are the electrons going to come from? What could attack this to break that? Yeah? The chloride up on top, right? So we can move it down and mix it here. Right? So that chloride down at the bottom can open the strained ring, and we get the addition of two chlorines. So what happened was we had two things happening at first. This is being like an SN2 reaction, forming a bond and chloride leaving. These electrons coming in to form a second bond. So the electrophilic addition of chlorine to an alkene is both electrophilic, that's the red part, but also nucleophilic simultaneously. Right? So both are really going on, although it's almost always referred to as electrophilic addition. Right? So it gives this intermediate, and then you can have something very like an SN2 reaction and get the dichlorinated product. And the same thing works with bromine. Now, not only can you do that, you can get things called halohydrins because they have both halogen and hydroxide in them. So if you do this same trick that we just talked about and get the intermediate, it could be a solvent that comes in and does the SN2 kind of reaction, right? In which case you'd get this, and that, of course, can lose a proton to another solvent molecule, and you have that product with Cl and OH being added, and Professor Siegel showed you that one as well. Okay, now, look at the regiochemistry that's involved in the bromonium compound. Just as we saw before with mercury, the bromine, although it's attached to both carbons, is not necessarily exactly halfway between the two carbons. It can be a little bit more on one side than on the other, so that there's more of a cation on the more substituted carbon. Now, notice that it can be attacked, therefore, at this carbon, even though it's more substituted, it can be attacked there because that's where more of the positive charge is. So you could have bromine come in and get the addition of the bromine to the original double bond. That's obtained in 24% yield in this reaction because, as it says, most of the positive charge is on this tertiary carbon and not much is on the primary carbon. But if there's water in the reaction, that can do the second attack instead of bromine, so you can go down and get this product, and that, in this particular case, that was formed in twice more than twice the yield of this one. So it's possible to do both, but the important thing from this slide is the regiochemistry, that whichever one you make, the nucleophile attacked at this more substituted carbon. Notice you can't tell that in this case because they're both bromines and you don't know which one went in first, but you certainly know it in this case where oxygen came in second. Okay, so that's the regiochemistry that's involved. So the halohydrin shows Markovnikov regiochemistry. The positive thing came in at the less substituted carbon and the nucleophile at the more substituted. And this is just like the oxymercuration where you have an unsymmetrical bridge. Now, how do we really know the ion is bridged? Because we would have gotten the same product, wouldn't we, if we had just added the Br plus only to this carbon? We still would have gotten the same product here and the same product there. How do we know it's bridged? Can you think of any way of telling that it's bridged? Yeah, Mike? Pardon me? No, you can't have both bromines on the same carbon. At least I don't think I understand you. Because once you put this bromine on one carbon, the other one has to go on the other. There are already three other things bonded to that carbon that the bromine's gone on to. Maybe I didn't understand you.
I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Like, pardon me?
I think that's what I'm trying to say. It's that since you already have both of them, whichever one the next
Oh yeah, that's absolutely true. You're right. But how? But no, if you had added the bromine to just one of the carbons rather than bridging, then the second bromine or the OH would have come in on the other carbon anyhow. Right? How do you know it's bridged, Hila? Okay. If the original bromine were symmetrically bridged, right, then you probably would attack OH at this side, right? But you could imagine attacking it at the other side, okay, just because this one's less hindered. In fact, the second one always comes in at this side. But you can explain that either with an unsymmetrical bridge, which is what we just did, or you could say that the bromine wasn't bridging, it was just all on the right to begin with. Don? That's right. That's one possibility. You'd get rearrangement if you have an independent cation, right? Now, in this case, you already have, if the bromine attacked here, that carbon would already be tertiary. So there wouldn't be anything to gain by moving carbon with its electrons here, a rearrangement, and getting just a different tertiary cation. It wouldn't be downhill the way it sometimes is. So you might not do it. Okay, it would be harder than if it were much downhill. Okay, so we have to have some other way of telling whether it's forming two bonds to the carbon or just one. And the way to do it was alluded to, but not dwelt on, by Professor Siegel, which is studied to the stereochemistry, as shown here. Now, I think I have this on the next slide. Yeah, it's shown on that slide as well, but let's look at it here from the book. Okay, so you have cyclohexene, and you're going to add a bromine and an OH. But notice that this bromine and the OH can be on the same face of the cyclohexane, cis to one another, or on opposite faces of the cyclohexane as drawn here. Right? Now, if the first bromine is bridged like this, then the SN2 kind of reaction will come in from the opposite side and break open the ring, and you get trans product, whether it's bromine or OH that comes in second. Right? But if it weren't bridged, if the bromine were just on the top here, then it could attack the cation from either face. Right? Maybe not 50-50. But at least there should be some of each product. And in fact, the product is, there's no cis product, it's all trans. right? So that's evidence that the bromine is bridging, because it's holding the stereochemistry at each side, not going through a cation intermediate that can be attacked from either face. So stereochemistry also, as well as the absence of rearrangement, gives you evidence that the bromonium ion, as it's called, is bridged. Okay, so it attacks from the back side, and an unbridged one would have been attacked from both sides. So the addition is anti, to give a trans product in this case. Now, there are other simultaneous reagents that attack alkenes that are both electrophiles and nucleophiles at the same time, the way we just saw in the halogen. One of these is a carbene. It's where the carbon is doing the attacking. We just saw bromine doing the attacking. Another one is BH attacking. Another one is carbon with the help of zinc. Another one is an oxygen atom. Another one is three oxygen atoms as ozone. Another one is hydrogen attached to a metal, which you see in catalytic hydrogenation. And the final one is R attached to a metal, which you see in a process called metathesis and also in polymerization. So we're going to do some overkill here and go through all these, although we won't get through all of them today. But you'll see the parallelism in all these, that there's both an electrophile, a low LUMO, and a high HOMO acting at the same time in all of these reagents. So first, let's look at carbenes. Now, there was a guy named Jack Hine who had just gotten his PhD at Ohio State in 1950, or 49 probably, and went to Harvard to be a postdoc in the lab of Paul Bartlett, whom I've mentioned before, who was a physical organic chemist, as you know. So he wanted to do some physical organic experiment. And what he decided to do was study the reaction of hydroxide with chlorinated methanes. So with chloroform, dichloromethane, what have I done here? That should be a single chlorine here. Methyl chloride, dichloromethane, trichloromethane, and tetrachloromethane. Professor Bartlett, when he talked about this subsequently, said this is about as earthy a research project as could be appropriate for a postdoctoral person. Remember that all these guys in England had been studying SN1, SN2, E1, E2 reactions already in the 1930s, so this seemed to be pretty closed territory. But anyhow, Hine decided to study the rates of reactions. He had a reason for doing this, which you'll see. And he found that methyl chloride, CH3Cl, was very fast in the reaction with hydroxide. And methylene chloride was slow, and tetrachloromethane, carbon tetrachloride, was very slow. Could you explain that? How would you explain it? That as you put more chlorines on, the reaction gets slower. Any idea? Derek? Right, it's the lone pairs that repel, but it's actually what you normally would call it steric hindrance. The chlorines are roughly as big as a methyl group, right? And this is exactly what you would expect with methyl groups. Methyl chloride, ethyl chloride, up to T-butyl chloride, which remember doesn't do it at all. So this is just what you would expect, except there's something funny, which is that one is fast. What does that suggest to you? Yeah, Harry? Henry? Pardon me? There must be some other mechanism going on. And an experiment Hine did to check this was to study the reaction with sulfur anion as a nucleophile. And now it was fast, slow, very slow. Just what you would have expected, right? As you put more, make it more sterically hindered. Now, what's the difference between hydroxide and a sulfide? Do you remember? We've talked about this as nucleophiles. Which is the better nucleophile? Henry? Sulfide. Remember, when you go down the periodic table, the things become better at bonding to carbon compared to how they are for bonding hydrogen. So hydroxide is mostly a base, and sulfide is more a nucleophile, and this is what you expect for nucleophiles, right? And all three of these are what you expect for nucleophile, but not that one. So what do you think is happening? Any ideas about how hydroxide is reacting with CHCl3? Matt?
Pulling off an H,
acting as a base rather than as a nucleophile. So the first reaction, and it happens both with chlorine and bromine, is reacting as a base to give this anion. Why is that anion a reasonable one to give? And you don't get it in the other cases. Okay. Why is it easier to pull off a proton and get this anion than to pull off a proton from methyl chloride, CH3Cl, and get CH2Cl, or from this one and get CHCl2? Why is it better to have CCl3 anion? Any ideas?
Wait, compared to what?
Yeah, compared to the other two. This, in the other cases, the previous cases, which is confused by the fact that that should be CH3Cl, this doesn't happen, right? It's nucleophilic substitution. What's special in this case? Yeah. It's the inductive effect. The chlorine withdraws electrons and makes anions more stable, right? So it's easier to do this in this case. Of course, you can't do it in that case because there's no H. Okay? And now, what can you imagine something that could do? What often happens to an R group that, or sometimes happens to an R group that has a chlorine on it? It breaks heterolytically, right? That's an SN1 reaction. Now, so this can undergo a SN1 reaction because it's got a really high HOMO here. It's very unstable, so it's easy to lose. The Cl minus is much more stable than C minus. Okay? So in fact, it undergoes, in this first case, is just an acid-base reaction. The second one is like the first step of an SN1 reaction, losing the leaving group, except that what you get is a really weird carbon, right, that has only two valences used, right? So it's called a carbene. It's an ene, remember, in the sense of Hoffman when he named these things, that it's lost two hydrogens, the carbon, right? So these things are called carbenes, and there are other ways of mentioning it, of making such compounds that are mentioned in the book here, but this is the one that we're particularly interested in. And this is called alpha elimination. Remember I said before when we talked about elimination, E2 or E1, it was beta elimination, where you take a H from one carbon and the leaving group from the other one. This one, you take both the H and the leaving group from the same carbon, because there is no other carbon, so you can't possibly do that one. Now, so here you have this thing, not surprisingly, is very reactive, and it can react with alkenes to form a cyclopropane. Okay? Now, as we say, most reactions in this lecture use analogous LUMOs and HOMOs to mix with the pi HOMO and the pi star LUMO of ethylene so as to form two bonds simultaneously. So they're the two bonds. Now, let's analyze the carbene as to what its HOMO and what its LUMO should be. So if it's bent at chlorine like that, what do you think, what two orbitals are left over? Robin? If this is, say, a 120-degree angle here, and it's pretty close to that, what other two orbitals are left on the carbon? I can't hear very well. Yeah, there's going to be a p orbital going up and down here, and there's going to be an orbital going this way. What hybridization will it have? So this is going to be planar here, right? Together with the other orbital. It'll be sp2. Which of them is a better place for electrons? The p orbital or the sp2? sp2, it's got more s character. Okay, so the HOMO is going to be this, and that's where the unshared pair will be. And the LUMO is going to be that. Okay? Now, had these been hydrogen, there things could be a little different. I'm not going to dwell on this, though Professor Jones, in writing the book, dwells a lot on the case where these two are hydrogen, because that's the research that he did as a high school student, as an undergraduate, as a graduate student with Professor During here, and he continued doing it when he went to Princeton. If you have two H's, it could be a different case, because this LUMO is being stabilized, or is acting to stabilize unshared pairs on the chlorine. So this is the best way to do it for this. But if you don't have the unshared pairs here to be stabilized, then one of these electrons can go here, because that the LUMO is lower in that case. So you can have one electron here and one electron here. So the book spends a lot of time on that, and we're not going to. Okay, we'll just talk about the case here of dichlorocarbene. Okay, so it has that HOMO and that LUMO. Can you see any problems in making these two bonds simultaneously in this way? Pardon me?
They're orthogonal.
Right? If you look at the signs, the HOMO of the carbene, you want to react with the HOMO of the alkene, and the LUMO you want to react with the LUMO of the alkene. The LUMO of the carbene, you want to react with the HOMO of the alkene. But the HOMO of the alkene is a plus top and bottom; it's the pi orbital, and the LUMO is plus minus. So they just are exactly backwards. Both pairs are orthogonal. Right? What could you do about that? How could you make it so they're not orthogonal? Who answered my question before? Sharif. Was it Sharif? Somebody answered this question at the beginning of the class. It was Henry. With chlorine. What did you do in the case of chlorine? Rotate it. Okay? So in fact, this is the calculated transition state where I used F2 carbon, because it's easier to calculate than Cl2 carbon. It's fewer electrons. Okay, so let's watch the motion as it goes to the transition state. It comes in sideways, right, to change which orbital is pointing which way. So the HOMO here mixes with the LUMO. The HOMO here mixes with the other LUMO, so you make those two new bonds. So as you move through the transition state, this will be shrinking, new bonds forming. This will be stretching, a double bond going to a single bond, and this will be rotating. So let's watch it. So isn't that cute? It rotates into the reaction rather than sliding in. Let's back up once and you can see it. Right? So it rotates into the reaction, at least as calculated. That's very hard to prove experimentally. But the calculation shows that to be the transition state, right? So the transition state, let's look at the orbitals in the transition state. There's the LUMO of the dichlorocarbene, which mostly is that p orbital that Robin told us about, right? And here's the HOMO, so they overlap well. Okay? And then if we look at the HOMO of the difluorocarbene, you see it's mostly this sp hybrid here, and that interacts well with red blue blue with the LUMO pi star of the alkene, so you can make both bonds at the same time in the transition state, but only if you come in sideways and then rotate to make the bonds. Okay. Now, how do you know that was just a calculation? How could you do an experiment that would show that both bonds form at once, that you don't form one bond to one carbon and then wait and form the second bond? How did we know in the case of bromine, for example, the bromonium ion, that it was bridged? Pardon me? The stereochemistry. So we can do the same thing here. So this is taken here. If you do dibromocarbene with this cis, the Z isomer of butene, you get the cis isomer of the dibromo cyclopropane, right? Whereas had it added just one end and given two radicals here as an intermediate, which subsequently coupled, it would have been possible to rotate, right? So that you could have gotten the trans as well as the cis. But in fact, you get only the cis. So again, stereochemistry shows that you form both bonds at the same time. Okay, so then we came to BH, which is another one that was previewed for us by Professor Siegel. So this is a two-step thing, which is hydroboration first, and then in a second stage, to make it practical for what you want to make, oxidation. So the hydroboration comes first, and then a second stage of oxidation using here hydrogen peroxide and base. So HB, boron hydrogen, adds to the double bond on the same side. H and B add on the same side. Remember these things we've looked at before. The two things that added were anti on opposite sides. Here they're on the same side. Okay? And then the Br2 is replaced by oxygen in this reaction. Right? So we get a cyclohexanol. So we've added H and OH. We've added them from the same side, not from opposite sides. Right? And there's another interesting thing about it. Can you see what's different about this alcohol from the front, the one you would have gotten if you had added H plus and then water, or mercury and then water and replaced mercury with hydrogen? What's special about this? What other possibility could you have envisioned for adding H and OH? Well, you could have imagined trans as well as cis, but what else? Don? This is anti-Markovnikov. So you remember what Professor Siegel said, if you're a synthetic chemist, you want ways of making all possible positions, regiochemistry. So you want to be able not to make H, not only to make HOH, but to make OHH. Right? This is anti-Markovnikov. So if you do it this way, you get the other alcohol. Okay, now let's look at the transition state for BH3 attacking. Now, what do you think the low LUMO is going to be? It's going to be BH3 that's going to be attacking. What's the low LUMO of BH3? The P orbital on boron. But if you're having a high HOMO at the same time, what's the high HOMO? We saw this already last semester with the dimerization. Yeah. It's the BH bond, which is a high HOMO. So we could have both of them happen. Now here's the transition state for this one. Right? You're going to do both of those reactions at once. And this is why they come in on the same side of the double bond, because they both add at once. The boron adds to one carbon, the H adds to the other. So again, it's rotating, shrinking, watch it here. So there's that. Right? So this is the transition state, okay, for that reaction. So it's BH3 and propane there. So there's the vacant orbital, the P orbital on boron, as Matt said. Here's the HOMO, which overlaps with that. Here's the LUMO, which is a BH bonding, or the HOMO of BH3, unusually high because of the boron. And here's LUMO plus 3, it turns out, of this. But this is calculated at the transition state when things are beginning to get pretty messed up. So it doesn't look very much like the P orbital of... like the pi star orbital of doesn't look exactly like the pi star orbital of propene, but you can see that that's what it is. Here's blue, red, red, blue, right? So those overlap well, and you form these things at the same time. Now, once you've done that, you've got boron attached to an R, right, and an H also on that R. Right? It was an alkene, right? But you still have a BH bond if you started with BH3. So you can do the same reaction again, add to a second alkene, add to a third alkene, and now you have three R groups attached to B. Right? It wouldn't be methyl, although I use that for illustration here, just for simplicity. It wouldn't be methyl because it had to add to an alkene. The boron add to one carbon, the H to another, so there have to be at least two carbons when you do that. But for purposes of showing the reaction, the second step of the reaction, I used methyl here just for simplicity. So now we're going to do... Nobody wants this compound. What they want is the alcohol, right? So you react with hydrogen peroxide. So we have a high HOMO here and a low LUMO, vacant orbital on boron, so you can make the bond. Okay, so you have that. And now, this thing reacts with itself. What do you notice is an unusually low LUMO in this compound? You no longer have a vacant orbital on boron. Madeline, what do you think? Can you see any place in this molecule where there might be an unusually low energy orbital? Can't hear very well. Sigma star OH is indeed lower. Why is it low? Yeah, because the O is so low in energy compared to carbon. But there's another bond that's going to be even lower for the same reason. It was lower because it had an oxygen, right? How can you do better? Bell? Shirley? Two oxygens, right? So sigma star here is going to be really low. Okay? Now, where is there an unusually high orbital? Or where are there unusually high orbitals in this thing? Caitlin, do you have an idea? Well, it's true the lone pairs of oxygens are high, but there's something that makes things even higher than that here, right? The negative charge. So that's not an unshared pair, right? There are no unshared pairs on boron. But all these bonds, this bond, and the bonds to R here, are all unusually high, those sigma orbitals, because of the negative charge. So now we have a low LUMO here, and high HOMOs here, in particular this one. Now, why would I choose that high HOMO? Look where it's situated compared to the LUMO. Right? So if we take these electrons and mix with sigma star, remember, which has a node here and is big here and big here, right? Then I can do like an SN2 reaction, where these electrons are attacking sigma star and that's breaking. Right? So that's the transition state for the reaction. You see, the CH3 is taking these electrons and coming over to begin to bond to oxygen, and at the same time, this bond is beginning to stretch. So you see, that's the same, really, as up at the top, the transition state for an SN2 reaction. This carbon here is being replaced by oxygen. Here's the nucleophile coming in, the leaving group leaving, the nucleophile coming in, the leaving group leaving. It's very much the same. If we so here chloride is attacking sigma star CBr, right? And here on the bottom, sigma boron carbon, or I should say boron minus carbon, which is what makes it so high, is attacking sigma star OO. Okay? So it's the same kind of reaction. Okay, and there's motion back and forth across the transition state. So if you look at the orbitals in the transition state, they look almost identical between these two cases. Here's the HOMO in the case for the rearrangement. Here's the HOMO in the case for SN2. They look almost exactly the same. Here's the LUMO in both cases. And again, they look almost exactly the same. So this really is like an SN2 reaction. Okay, so why do hydroboration oxidation if it just adds H and OH to that? And this, as we said before, this is just reviewing that, is that it gives the anti-Markovnikov. The product is syn, so we control the stereochemistry because the H and the Br came in on the same side. Right, and the O then in this rearrangement replaces the Br exactly where it's attached to the R group here. Right, so these still have to be syn, and it's anti-Markovnikov. So you have good control over which of the products you get by using this hydroboration oxidation approach, in contrast to acid-catalyzed hydration, where you can get scrambling. There's no syn-anti control. It's Markovnikov, and it can undergo rearrangement. So there's a lot more control here. Now there's another reaction called a carbenoid. So it's sort of like a carbene, but it isn't exactly. This one is not in the book, but I put it in here anyhow because it's an interesting mechanism. So diiodomethane, methylene iodide, attacks here to give a cyclopropane, right, and zinc iodide. The zinc is what makes it reactive. Okay, so this is a pretty good reaction. It's 60% yield on that one. Now, it starts up, one reason I'm starting here is because including this is because it involves a metal. Now, if you have a metal and Rx, how can they react? Well, metals don't hold, there are some electrons they don't hold tightly. They're good at giving up electrons to give metal cations, right? Where could an electron go in Rx? Where is there a low LUMO? Sharif?
Sigma star.
Sigma star, right. So you can actually take an electron out of the metal, a single electron transfer, and put it into Rx. Now when you put that electron into Rx, you get an anion radical. And the metal, you know, it's a big piece of metal, it's not just an atom, it has lost an electron, so it's a plus and a radical. Now, where that electron went into which orbital again, Sharif?
Sigma star.
So what effect does that have on the Rx bond?
It'll break it.
So this bond can then break, right? So you get a metal with R rad, which has an odd number of electrons, and X minus leaves, and now these things can come together to form an R metal bond. Okay? So you get a metal with a little bite out of it there, where a metal atom has come off and formed a bond to R. Right? So this is the way that alkyl halides become organometallic compounds, or one way that they do that. Okay, so that's what begins with the zinc. So you get, in this process, zinc forming a bond to the carbon here. Now, what you could imagine losing the zinc, this being treated as if it were a salt, right? So the zinc cation is separate from this. You can imagine losing iodide here as we did to form a carbene, and you can imagine then this forming a carbene, methylene. But in fact, it doesn't do that. They stay connected. Okay? So the next three slides suggest a plausible mechanism, but it's incorrect. And then I'll show you the correct mechanism. So let me go quickly through the plausible mechanism, and next time we'll show the correct one. So here's a model for IZNCH2I, the actual reagent. I'm replacing this R group by this R group just so I can calculate it. So there's the LUMO, which is mostly on the zinc, right, the 4s orbital of zinc mostly. And here's the LUMO plus 1, which is a vacant orbital on zinc here. Okay. Now, here is a transition state for that thing to attack the alkene. There's the LUMO when it's bent, so it has a vacant orbital that can overlap with pi. It's a hybrid orbital on zinc. There's the HOMO. So we can form a bond. But at the same time, this LUMO can interact here to mix with the HOMO of the zinc reagent, can mix with the LUMO here. Okay, so you form two bonds at once. So that's a lot like the boron hydrogen that we just looked at in hydroboration. The boron goes to one carbon, the H goes to the other. In this case, zinc goes to one carbon and carbon goes to the other. So you can now get, now you've done an addition to the alkene involving both electrophile and nucleophile. Right? Now, had we used the diiodide, which we didn't use because the orbitals would have looked more complicated, then we'd have this, and now you can have the HOMO here, right? A metal ion makes that HOMO, sigma zinc, attack the LUMO here, sigma star. So in a thing very like what we just saw, you can form a new bond, break the bond to iodide in a sort of SN2 reaction, and get this. Okay, so that's a plausible mechanism. But it's not what you really calculate, and I'll show you that one next time.
Yeah.